Right, let's start, shall we? We're going to aim to finish by five, so let's get started on this. Barbara, as you're sitting there, should we start off with the intangible assets?
Sure.
And we need to find Lily somewhere as well.
I knew.
Oh.
I'll try to separate between the question for CMAQ versus GPS on the intangible versus goodwill. There was a discussion about, so there was support for separating definite live intangibles like licenses, but not necessarily indefinite live intangibles, so like client lists, for example. There was a discussion that if you have indefinite live intangibles that might be considered to be more organically created, you might also be double counting expenses already in your P&L with your sales and marketing. So if you have sales and marketing expense for these and you're amortizing them, you may have a lot of your double counting expense. You could be double counting expense. Also, there are other costs that we have today that we don't capitalize that could also be creating organic. As we know, we don't capitalize internally generated intangibles today, so there's sales and marketing related to those that aren't being capitalized, and they feel there's contradiction in some of these kind of organic intangibles if you separate them out, what they're seeing as indefinite live. There's some that say they don't really see a value in separating indefinite live intangibles out again. They're also have sympathy. The ones who don't see the value in separating them out also have some sympathy with the preparers, understanding that it's difficult to value and identify those indefinite live intangibles. Then there are others that say they should be separated, the indefinite live intangibles should be separated out if you're going to amortize goodwill. So I'd say overall from the users, there seemed to be support for separating at least the definite live intangibles out from the goodwill. On the preparer side, they are also saying they think it's only useful if the life is definite to separate it out. The preparers are also saying it's difficult to implement and value the indefinite live intangibles, and the impairment test on those would be judgmental. Does anyone want to add anything on that one before I move to the next? I think my group is not here. So on the goodwill, basically on the non-amortization of goodwill. So I'd say most supported, maybe 50-50 on the investors actually supported goodwill impairment. They're saying it's useful to monitor the stewardship of the company, it's useful to see the value on the balance sheet and keep the impairment test. They are able to monitor synergies that were created from the acquisition and seeing the goodwill. Those that support the goodwill impairment test believe that amortization is more of a mindless exercise, and because there's an arbitrary allocation of a life, of a definite life, or sorry, a useful life. Then there were, I'd say, some in the middle who talk about they're worried about seeing the step decline in the P&L due to the impairment all of a sudden when the management decides the acquisition doesn't go well. And they were saying, why couldn't we just amortize and then assess for impairment every year? There was a thought process about, because you're realizing synergies over time and you should be realizing some potential from the acquisition over time, then you should also be decreasing the goodwill over time because it's no longer the same amount you thought you would have because you're recognizing these synergies over time. Others, however, think that goodwill should be amortized completely. It has a finite life. It's an excess profit. And they're concerned about the impairment test being complex and subjective. The only other comments that were made about the impairment versus amortization is there was a timeliness comment about sometimes the market already adjusts for impairment, so some are saying it's not worth doing the impairment test if the market already adjusted. Others say the timeliness doesn't matter, it's still good information. Plus, we have timeliness issues in other accounting applications, so the market might have already adjusted for other issues in accounting that we don't worry about, so we shouldn't necessarily focus on the timeliness of this. And the judgment, there was the same comment about judgment. A lot say that there's a lot of judgment going into the impairment test, but the same argument was made, well, we have a lot of judgment and other accounting requirements as well, so we shouldn't just focus on the judgment and the timeliness of that impairment. Actually, that's just the users. I'm sorry. I'm almost finished. On the preparer side, I think it is. So the preparers were saying, okay, the test to impair goodwill is complex. Now they're looking at a different entity to assess impairment than the one before the acquisition. It's not as simple for them to allocate the costs and figure out where the cash flows are going once they develop synergies with the newly acquired business. They're concerned that the complex assumptions and adjustments that go into the estimates could create inconsistent calculations and assessments. And I think the only other main comment I have is that if we do decide to change and start amortizing goodwill, they would like us to do this jointly with the FASB. Yes. Did I miss anything?
Mine was much more short. Me as well. I talked. All right. On the first question on separate recognition of intangible assets from goodwill, we had one very passionate user who didn't believe that there should be any separation of intangible assets from goodwill. He thought that there should just be an assessment of impairment. What else? The other there were a few more other users who disagreed with him. Oh, and it was quite a great time watching ping pong match. Because these other users thought that they appreciated that there's a lot of judgment made in to get out these figures, but they thought that separating out all the between the goodwill and the intangible assets provide insight on what are different types of how the entity views those cash flows are, how those different assets are assessed. Sorry, provides insight on the different intangible assets and the cash flows that they would provide to the entity going forward. Then for the preparers, they did appreciate that there were implementation challenges on separately recognizing intangible assets from goodwill. A lot of it was because sometimes how top management buys companies is that it's based on a particular value that some management based on, perhaps based on share price or based on EBITDA, which may not necessarily reflect on what the individual, what they bought. So it's a matter of judgment of how they're going to translate what top management has decided and translating all the different assets and liabilities to get the figures that IFRS 3 requires. Then we went on to non-amortization of goodwill and indefinite life intangible assets. The users in the group all agreed that there shouldn't be amortization of these assets. They thought it should be based on impairment of asset or impairment based on the impairment model. They appreciated that the impairment model that we have now could be improved because sometimes the market could, like Mark or Barbara says, sometimes the market gets that information early, so maybe consideration of an implicit hint from the group that the ISB might consider improving the impairment model. And then the preparers, they preferred amortization of intangibles because one preparer thought that this reflected that when a company buys another company, the intangible asset or the goodwill just doesn't stay there by itself. It requires something like a fund. You need to take care of that asset so that it maintains its value. So it reflects the fact that this goodwill, you have it there, you need to take care of it, otherwise it just wouldn't stay at value. So there's amortization reflects the fact that some of it goes down and the entity itself is taking care of that bought company. And then another preparer said that it's better to amortize the intangible assets because it's also less complex. Have I reflected that?
Good. Should we take comments, questions on this bit first before we move on to the other one? Anybody want to add anything? Peter?
The reason I'm in favor of goodwill amortization is that what I see is companies that are paying for super profits. And this can be easily seen today when we have this merger mania or merger acquisition mania or whatever it's called. 2-3 years ago, the number of acquisitions were much fewer than today. Those were, when they bought the company 2-3 years ago, they were valued much lower than today. After 3 years with increasing share prices, all of a sudden everybody wants to buy a company. To me, it's quite obvious that the companies need to pay a little bit too much because they are not for sale at the bottom when they are cheap. So consequently, I need some kind of method that gets this super profit amortized over time. And to me, that is amortization of goodwill. The problem I have with the method is the following. If I look at the valuations on the stock exchanges, most stock exchanges, we constantly value the equity in the company more than 100%. The average in Stockholm is 210% over a 15-year period. It varies, but it is never as low as 100%. So obviously, also, we have some kind of accounting error included in the accounts. And that I don't really want to amortize. I want to amortize the super profit part of it, but not the accounting error part of it. How to calculate that? I can also talk about that, but I will not. So, but I think it would be definitely a better model, better fit to the real economics that we work in to amortize on goodwill, but not on the whole amount.
Lots of passionate views, aren't there, on this particular subject, and I respect Peter's view on it, but there are others equally as passionate for the impairment. And you know, I find this subject very difficult because nothing really seems that good in the accounting in this area. And anyway, Tanya.
So there's two things that I thought that I wanted to bring out. I mean, the question about breaking out in the sense of goodwill, various intangible assets out of goodwill. I think the concern in our group when users then actually had a subsequent discussion was, in fact, there's not really that much discussion about there are obviously assets that the business believes it may be acquiring. But we think at the moment, because a company is able to amortize a certain component of those intangibles, it games the system. It encourages them to essentially inflate the value of those assets within the goodwill context such that they can then amortize that away. So you could take the gaming of the system out by saying, sure, you can identify all the various assets within the intangibles and the goodwill, but then be consistent as to how you value that goodwill. Either you have to amortize all of it, or you impair all of it. I'm unfortunately going to argue passionately against Peter. I believe that a dollar of the shareholders' capital that has been put at risk with a cash purchase of a company, and hence goodwill is identified, then should be challenged period after period as to whether or not that value is still inherent, given that you've paid for those cash flows into the future. So I'm very much of the view that, sure, identify what intangibles you like within your acquisition. Any insights that management wants to give the investors as to what they've paid for, fantastic. But you've paid for those assets. You don't utilise those assets over a constant period of time. Some brand names will last for 5 years, some brand names may last for 50 years. And amortising them equally over a constant period of time does not recognise those differences. And therefore, an impairment test is a far better, I think, insight as to whether or not what you pay for is still there in the value of the company.
Mitch?
In the interest of having it all, what precludes a company from doing both? So, for example, I completely agree with you. At an absolute minimum, you know, the impairment test on goodwill on an annual basis, you know, to test whether management's made the right decision, whether the acquisition will grow, will realize the value. On the other hand, goodwill that doesn't get impaired, that sits on the balance sheet for 10 years, doesn't make any sense to me either. It can't possibly have the same value in year one as it does in year 10. If that potential converts to reality and over time that acquisition creates value which falls to equity, then theoretically that goodwill should decline as the value, as that acquisition grows into the value that was expected. So I don't know why it has to be this either or. You would with a piece of equipment, you would revalue it. There was a technology change, and then that would reset the depreciation. It probably derails everything, but it's why. I mean, there's some principles-based reason why they're not. They're mutually exclusive.
Okay. Can I just say that the arguments which we're hearing here are arguments that the board considered long and hard when this was initially debated. In fact, there's only one board member still present that went through those discussions, even Wegra and myself, that arrived 7 years ago. We weren't here for that first round of discussions on Arbus 3, or we were for the second. We could, of course, just reopen the whole thing and start from scratch and debate it all over again. But should we do that? So I'd be interested to hear, should we just reopen IFRS 3 in its entirety?
Okay, that's a pretty challenging one than what I had was going to talk about. Picking up the point about your, Tanya, your idea that one should minimise the goodwill, I wonder why you're saying that and not saying maximise the goodwill. Because many times goodwill gets subsumed into a larger cash generating unit and typically is protected by the already existing profits from that cash generating unit. So actually, typically goodwill itself is, it depends, but often gets lost very quickly in the bigger pot of goodwill and bigger value of the cash generating unit. And actually does therefore never gets actually individually assessed for impairment.
I wasn't saying maximising or minimising goodwill, it's just that by the information from the company in terms of the other assets that they believe they've acquired, we get insights into what the acquisition is supposedly about. So I wasn't talking about maximising or minimising goodwill, I have no interest either way. It's just that if the management can identify other intangible assets they believe they've acquired, it gives me some insight as to what they actually think they've purchased.
Quickly, one sentence, picking up. I mean, I think there are a number of flawed areas in IFRS 3.
Exactly.
I think there's, we're going to talk about the flawed area with contingent consideration, flawed area with step acquisitions, potentially a flawed area with what we're talking about now. So if you have the guts,
yes,
start again.
Check.
As an analyst covering the telecom industry, which, if you remember, the ESMA report shows that the telecom industry in Europe is the industry with most goodwill. My experience with impairment tests is that the information we've got is completely irrelevant. In many cases, it's highly subjective, and I'm polite. Most cases where they deliver impairment, it comes years after everybody is conscious that they made an unreasonable investment. So does it provide me any information? No. Then let's look at the concept, not the practice. For me, the impairment itself is flawed because when you test the goodwill at the cash generating unit, you measure the goodwill you acquired and you recorded with the goodwill of the cash generating unit, which includes the goodwill you acquired, the goodwill you recreated since you operated the acquired business, and the goodwill you had previously, for instance, in a country with your previous business, which is now merged with the acquired entity. So isn't the concept of the impairment test solid enough to guarantee me that the goodwill I acquired, and which is in my books, is not overvalued? No, it cannot work. So the concept, it does explain why we have so poor results, by the way. Then I have a fundamental question about the concept of non-amortization. The basic reason why the boards decided not to move not to amortize is they say it's indefinite. It's difficult to measure, but I have plenty of assets in many businesses which are difficult to assess what is the expected economic life. I mean, in the telecom industry, currently it's 4G. 4G equipment is brand new. We don't know which would be the best supplier, which would be the demand, which would be the traffic, which would be the technology obsolescence. Still, I don't stop depreciating this equipment. I make reasonable guess, and I would expect that
on goodwill, the management should do the same thing. Reasonable guess. The fact that it's indefinite does not prevent me non-motivation. That's my the way I look at it.
Okay.
Yes. You know, several people talked about timing impairment. You know, when impairment occurs, you know, many cases, you know, stock market already is aware, and then everything is reflected in the stock price already. That's one thing. And secondly, when I discuss with management regarding impairment of the goodwill, always I got a strong pressure that they prefer to have either motivation or impairment, actually impairment when company is good. But, you know, this in current accounting practice doesn't allow that. So I get a fundamental feeling that there may be some improvement in a way that, you know, model of goodwill, either impairment model or amortization, you know, to be taking place, like he said. And also, you know, when it comes to, you know, acquired company, you know, company itself doesn't be the same in 10 years after the acquisition because of integration with the company's existing resources, organization, or sometimes, you know, broken out into a, you know, new organization, or, you know, so, you know, 10 years from acquired date, you know, reporting me to assess that the goodwill is totally different. So I find it very sort of difficult to follow non-impairment, impairment model, non-amortization. So I would assume that there may be some way that we can show that amortization model, and also show that to a disclosure to the market, that this is about amortization cost, amortization expenses, so that the user could can clearly tell. So that's how I see it.
Yeah, I think from my standpoint that the interesting thing about the goodwill debate is that it tends to occupy a lot of this, and what everyone seems to say is I'm using this as an indicator of the success or failure of the business. But from an investor perspective, I listen to investment pitches all the time, every day. I've never heard anyone buy or sell a company based on goodwill. So I think the focus around the usefulness of goodwill as an indicator of the quality of an acquisition is a little silly, because when the impairment occurs, like you said, everybody already knew it was a bad acquisition. Amortization is somewhat arbitrary. There's no good answer there. I think the focus needs to be, and maybe I'm getting ahead of this here, but the focus needs to be on decision useful information, pro forma information, pre and post acquisition. That gives us a real sense of how the business is performing. I think nobody really relies on goodwill as a barometer for whether or not it was a good acquisition. I think it's important to discuss, and how we treat it's very important because obviously it's a huge number. But using it, discussing it as a indicator of the quality of an acquisition to me is the wrong way to think about it. I think you need to rely on other things.
I want to take up the question about whether the whole standard should be reopened. And when considering that, the question is, have we learned anything? Would the debate be significantly different? This is a standard that is deeply entrenched in fair value, and I think that's actually the long-term trend. So I don't think we would change. I don't think collectively there are any new issues out there. And so you don't change something unless it's really broken. Amortization has huge problems. By the way, I prefer amortization, but that's a side issue. Don't change something unless it's really broken, and the fix here isn't clear. Amortization isn't a clear advantage. I would, as a sort of a recommendation, I think what you should do is selectively go and look at the, if you're going to do things, I would suggest throwing it out for a moment. I go after impairment, and I tighten up the rules about impairment, because I think most of us are very, we don't think, I think most users don't think impairment is necessarily well done. So it would tighten up the rules about impairment, forcing impairment, both the auditors and the preparers to be more critical and maybe do it faster. And I would try to try and fix some of the problems that we see. I agree that our group is going to talk about step, and we think there are problems there too. But I don't think reopening it would I think the debate would be very similar, and it would be really, if we got a different answer, it was because that day the board members happened to be, we're very close to a tipping point in what we would end up with. So I don't think there's value in opening it up. I do think there's value in tightening up some of the rules.
The trouble is different people will tighten up different rules, and we end up with looking at everything because somebody says that bit is wrong or that bit should be tightened.
And if you can't get even a if you can't get a consensus on tightening up the rules, then clearly there is no consensus. You don't open it up unless there's a real consensus into which way to go. So if there isn't even a consensus on we should tighten up impairment, well then maybe you do nothing. I thought there was, I think most people are concerned about impairment. Maybe I misheard the conversation.
Well, we're still in the process of getting the feedback from the post-implementation review, and the board will have to make these decisions in the future, but this is useful, interesting input. Peter and Martin, you've got some additional comments on this. I want to get on and just have the feedback on the last points, but briefly.
I think it is a huge difference between 10 years from now and now, because now we know. We know that the impairment test doesn't work as it was intended to work. We talked 10, 15 years ago about cash generating units. We talked about cash flows coming in, being able to compare to the goodwill amount. But what we see and what we hear is that we bundle it all together, either in the segment or in the total group, and we cannot separate anything. So we are in a doldrum, totally. I don't think that was the intention 10 years ago. At all. And then if we look at supervisors all over Europe, they agree on one thing. The impairment test is not timely. It doesn't give you information that is useful. So I think definitely it is completely different now. We had a period of goodwill amortization for 20 years. Now we have had this impairment test for 10 years. Why shouldn't we discuss it? Why shouldn't we open up? It's not the perfect world we live in. This is definitely not one.
Toxic board reaction. Okay, brief comments, Martin.
I'm very much in favor of Dan's comments, and that we're maybe focusing on the wrong pieces of information here. Investors want information post acquisition, how it went. We need to project companies that make acquisitions, and we're having a hard time. It takes us lots of time to analyze companies that did a major acquisition. And at the moment, we need to wait too long to find a reasonable basis to base our projections on. And that's something that needs a fix. That's a problem. Impairment is not a problem. I mean, it's an enforcement problem, but not a standards problem. And does it provide users useful information if a company is 3 years late in an impairment? Yes, it does. It tells you something about how long it takes that company to get real on an acquisition. And some companies will be sooner, and that's useful information as well. They are more realistic than other companies. So I think tidying up as a post-implementation review is all about is fixing small things like the acquisition-related assets which do not add an awful lot of value, and indeed the transaction cost that should be activated, and the post. Those are things you can fix, and then we should focus on the items that Dan was talking about.
The FASB and ISB are very close in their business combination standards, so. If you're going to make a movement on this, it would be preferable if you worked as a team to make any revisions. When I look at goodwill, it's really a fallout of all your other calculations. And what does it really represent? When I hear everybody talking, it sounds like the view is it really represents something that can be reliably measured. And I don't know if it really can. It's just where fair value was on that particular day, and you've got a gross up for your deferred taxes, and it's just a fallout. So I don't really know how you would determine your amortization period, what your amortization period should represent. Should it actually even be on your balance sheet? So, I question the balance and why it's there and why we amortize, or why we would consider amortizing.
It's there because they paid, right?
It's because they paid the money.
Well, they...
Cash repay, right?
Well, shares could have been paid, and you negotiated a transaction on one day and close it, and your share price could be, you know, $20 different. Did the deal really change that amount? It just is a factor of what happened on the particular closing date.
Dennis, last comment?
Yeah, on this timeliness argument, I think we're kind of selectively using that because, first of all, the general evidence about the relationship between accounting events and the share price is, let's say, modest, put it mildly. And then secondly, there are many other examples where there is an event, let's say Boeing has an order for 20 different planes, then the share price will respond. Are we going to ask the accountants to reflect the revenues? And what about there's a new technology that's announced, and then subsequently the share price is going to fall, and then later on the company's going to adjust the capitalized development expenditure. So I think the argument is flawed in terms of, and secondly, the evidence about the lack of timeliness is not unanimous from the academics.
No, it's a good job we didn't start off on this subject. We then never got to discuss anything else. But let's have a brief report back, shall we, on the other aspects that the other two groups are discussing. Leo, you want to go first?
Thank you. The first issue is the accounting for step acquisition. And the first question is about the usefulness of the information provided from the accounting for step acquisition. My understanding of the discussion is that the current accounting is not useful. This is because in a step acquisition, the acquirer accounts for a gain that is due to an assessment of the fair value of the previously held equity interest. Regarding the difficulties, one preparer said some difficulties in the elimination of the fair value of the entire business. Similar comments on the loss of control, even though one user said that there is a difference between loss of control and step acquisition, and so in this case, the fair value of the retained interest is a useful information. Regarding the accounting for contingent consideration, also in this case, the subsequent accounting for contingent consideration is not helpful, is counterintuitive. But the good thing, the good information is that now a user can see how the acquired business is going, because you have a profit or you have a loss according to the fair value measurement of the contingent. Transaction cost, I understand split view of transaction cost. Some prefer the current requirements, so accounting for P&L, others said no, should be part of the consideration. We will discuss the disputes.
Okay, our group had a fairly consistent discussion with that as well. On the step acquisitions, most of the group favoured a carryover basis, although one of the users thought that a current value might provide more useful information for future cash flows. A particular concern is about control premiums and squeeze-out premiums and the like, and whether they end up being applied to the whole block versus just the marginal block. We didn't discuss loss of control in any detail, although I had the sense that people had similar views to the ones they had about step acquisitions, but we didn't get very far into that. We did discuss the disclosure points. That focused really on the difficulties the preparers would have in isolating the post-acquisition performance of the acquiree. And the feeling was that in most cases it gets merged very quickly and loses identity very quickly. And that any attempt to isolate it would be fairly arbitrary and subjective. There was a suggestion that maybe we could use management commentary there for more of a qualitative discussion of comparison with the pre-acquisition targets, which apparently tend to be set largely for the combined business. So, for example, if you have an acquiry in a particular territory, you might have a post-acquisition target for the new combined entity in that territory. And maybe you could do something in management commentary comparing with your previous plans. But there was a general feeling that it probably wasn't going to be auditable information. So best to do that in commentary rather than financial statements. On contingent consideration, the concern there was that good news would be end up being reported as a loss, and that was found to be very difficult to explain to the users and very counterintuitive. It was also felt that it wasn't actually that big a deal, and that because it was so counterintuitive, you'd actually spend a long time trying to explain it, and that the amount of effort required to do that was really out of proportion to its importance. There was also a concern about the lack of consistency with the accounting for asset purchases, where you don't have the same accounting for contingent consideration, or at least it's not clear that you're going to be contingent consideration. On transaction costs, all of the users and a minority of the preparers favoured expensing them. One of the arguments was that there's no direct link between the costs incurred and the future cash inflows. Another concern was that if you capitalise them, you end up increasing goodwill, and then the goodwill never hits P&L unless you have an impairment. There was a majority of preparers felt that it would be more consistent to capitalise the costs for consistency with the treatment of asset purchases. But on this issue as well, most people thought it wasn't actually that big a deal and there were probably bigger fish to fry.
Barbara, do we have time to discuss this? What are your plans for the closed session?
We have a half hour closed session, so we spend 5 minutes discussing it.
Yeah. Okay. Any comments on what you've just heard?
Okay. I'm here on acquisition costs.
Keep them expense.
Keep expense them. It's a cost of being an acquisitive company.
The standard is based in fair value thinking. You need to expense it if you want to be consistent.
Well, then you shouldn't have capitalized in revenue recognition, or you shouldn't capitalize when you buy
In fairness, if you take that thinking just a one step further, what you really are looking at is the goodwill. Is an entity specific value that you shouldn't be capitalizing either. But so there's a limit how far you can take that thinking.
We are inconsistent in dealing with acquisition costs, both the measurement and the accounting. But that might be a whole separate project.
I tried to keep quiet, but because when Robert is starting to talk about fair value as an argument for expensing it, I need to point out that at least in Sweden, if a company buy real estate or a real estate company, the treatment differs. Yeah. And they constantly buy real estate companies. But still, and probably that is wrong, they put the cost on the asset side because they look at the acquisition of that real estate company as actually a bunch of assets. So I don't think that argument holds. To me, it's quite obvious that it must be some kind of connection between how we treat expense costs when we acquire a bunch of shares than when we acquire real estate or whatever. So I cannot really understand it. What I can understand is if you have a merger and an acquisition going on for a year or whatever, you cannot put that on the asset side all the time. But when you buy a company, you estimate a certain amount of costs that you will have for Morgan and for others in this room. And if you put that on the balance sheet, I cannot see how that is worse than what we have today, which becomes a quarter with a lot of cost, an impairment of inventory, and no one cares about that quarter. So we tend to look further ahead, and I think that is bad accounting. Now I will keep
One of the old board members said, if I could get a penny for every time we talk about costs and fair value, she would be rich. So that conversation goes on and on. Actually, but anyway, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate the importance of the pro forma information. I think it always surprises me how little attention this gets given the number of acquisitions and the impact they have on financial results. It's funny because on the one hand we're talking about contingent consideration, and yet you have companies that have earnouts, but they can't tell you the impact of the company. Like, how do you calculate what you owe on the earnout if you don't know how the target company is performing? Doesn't make any sense. I think there's so many situations where an analyst will be completely unable to understand what's going on with the business because everything is muddied by acquisitions. And in the US it's generally because of materiality issues, and anything below a certain threshold doesn't have to be disclosed. And it just makes analysis extremely, extremely difficult. There's a material difference in our understanding in cases in the U.S. where the company has to file an 8K with a pro forma set of financial statements versus those that they don't. It's such a large percentage of companies make acquisitions, and it just makes analysis very difficult.
All right, Jane, then Paolo, and then we'll get the last word to Mel.
Talking about transaction costs reminds me that in terms of information that's really useful, it's making sure that there's a proper record of the total acquisition costs, the equity, the debt assumed, maybe pension liabilities assumed, cost of restructuring, and the fees. And then if you know, because actually what we want to do is a probably return on that total investment over the years, and you know, IFRS 3 is not being the greatest help in that.
You make it sound very simple.
Yeah, just a quick comment to repeat it. I feel quite flattered as an M&A lawyer being included as part of the goodwill and directly related with cash flow. I believe I see myself an expense as a cost.
You asked me earlier why should we be relatively looking at IFRS 3, and I look at some of the challenges many of us propose have in explaining our results to our analysts, our users, our shareholders. It's often the complexity coming from acquisitions we've done, so people don't understand the amortization on whatever we bought, they don't understand the one-off inventory adjustments we make at the time of an acquisition. They don't understand the counterintuitive contingent consideration. I accept your point that if you have a turnout, that's so you clearly are keeping track of the bought company, but unfortunately contingent consideration goes further than that and doesn't just relate to earnout situations. So if you want to simplify and bring back financial reporting, I mean, if you actually want users and investors to focus on the as-published IFRS financial statements and don't have them focus on core or adjusted earnings, you need to make acquisition accounting simple.
And the problem is that analysts didn't focus on the IFRS financial statements pre-IFRS. They were just a different set of problems. This has been very interesting, and Leo's no doubt been taking detailed notes. He'll be bringing papers to the board in the future. I think we're going to have some difficult decisions on this particular subject. It'll make the post-implementation review of segment reporting look rather simple. I think this one is going to be a much more difficult thing for us to make decisions on. But thank you for your input on that. Thank you, team, for your help. And the board members that helped out as well. We're going to have a closed session.